listening to The Finalysis with Travis Wingfield and Kevin Dern. Brought to you by WelcomeToPerfectville.com. Prepare to go deep.
Those backs underneath. First and 10. And with a rookie left tackle on the move. Look at this run right here. Perriman. He'll take it all the way. That is what Baltimore does. And the answer to the Miami touchdown. A 53-yard catch and run by Rashad Perriman. What a play. His second consecutive week with a touchdown reception.
Welcome back to another installment of the Finalysis podcast. We are no longer streaking. Instead, we are picking up the pieces from a comprehensive beatdown from one of our most bitter foes as the Dolphins fall 38-6 in Baltimore. How's it going, Dolphins? Travis Wingfield here with you as always, joined by my co-host and resident defensive coordinator of Perfectville, Kevin Dern. Kevin, what's up, man?
Yeah, I guess all things good come to an end eventually, and I kind of figured after those first two drives we weren't going to pull out the W there in that game, so but hopefully we can start out a new streak this Sunday.
Yeah, it seems like that's kind of the agenda of the Dolphins this year, is to fall behind early, and they've been crawling back into games, and the offense responded a little bit early on, but they never got it figured out. They made some mistakes, and we'll get to that later in the offensive review, but it just never clicked for them, and the defense never got it figured out, and it was kind of one of those games where I just had accepted the fate pretty much, you know, from that second touchdown drive, as you had mentioned. I was pretty much out of it in terms of hoping for a win at that point. So not a fun Sunday, especially when you take into consideration the other games around the league that we needed to fall in a certain way. So pretty disappointing to go to Baltimore. And I think one of these days we might beat those guys when it matters, but not this time, Kevin.
We needed Dan Campbell. That's all I have to say about it. So
Dan Campbell and Cam Cameron, the only ones that can beat the Baltimore Ravens, apparently.
Yeah.
So that's, I believe, 6-0 now for Joe Flacco against the Dolphins, if I'm not mistaken, in his career. And, you know, I bashed him on the podcast last week saying he's a pretty bad quarterback. Over the last 2 years, his stats.
I think he's 6-1 because we beat Flacco last year, did we? Or was that a backup quarterback?
He was on IR last year when we played him. So, yeah, he was out for the year at that point. At least I think he was, or maybe that was later in the season he went out, but regardless, they were a pretty bad team last year, and I think it was Matt Schaub, but
okay, that's right.
Either way, yeah, that wasn't a very important win. This game was much more important, didn't fall our way. I predicted a blowout for the Dolphins. Of course, I was wrong the complete opposite way. The Ravens took it to the Dolphins from the opening gun and until the end, and even after the Dolphins scored a touchdown, there was that Rashad Perriman 58-yard or 53-yard touchdown pass there that just put it right back on the rocks, so Dolphins get blown out. We'll get into the review here in a little bit. Probably going to start with offense tonight because I think that was probably the better side of the ball, even though they only scored 6 points. But, Kevin, were you pretty much just, like, giving up on this game from that second drive on, or did you still have hope, or what were you thinking there?
I had a glimmer of hope when we got the fumble right at the beginning of the third quarter and scored. But then when we missed the two-point conversion, basically still kept it at a three-score game. And I was just like, there's no way we're getting those many points and stopping the Ravens at the same time. So that was actually the first time in a long time I haven't even finished watching a broadcast. I think I turned it off with about 5 minutes left.
Yeah, so once the Ravens went to Ryan Mallett, I was like, there's no point in even watching this. And I actually took more of an interest in the other games, like the Kansas City game and Eric Berry pretty much willing that team to victory yet again. So, you know, the games the Dolphins needed to fall their way just kind of went the other way late, like they have been lately. So it's just it was a bad Sunday for Dolphins fans and our hopes of the playoffs. They aren't dead yet. We are very much alive in the playoff race still. So we will get to the Arizona game later in the show, but let's start it off with the offensive review from last Sunday. I turned on the All 22 this morning reluctantly and got through it. So, Kevin, you got any more things you want to say before I get into that?
Let's just power through this one. I think it was a tough one.
Yeah, we're going to try to make it as brief as possible. I mean, we want to be comprehensive for you guys, but at the same time, we don't really want to, you know, harp on something that was so dreadful. So
yeah, we need to relive this one.
Yeah, and honestly, though, I did feel better after watching the film, at least from the offensive side of the ball. And I don't know if you can give me the same on the defense. We'll get to that later. But I felt better from offense because I know we didn't score any points in the first half, but we had four possessions, and it wasn't complete meltdowns on snap after snap after snap. They actually had a lot of positive snaps in the game. They just melted down at the very most critical points of the game and on the drives. You just can't make those kinds of mistakes against the second-ranked defense and a team that is as well-coached as the Ravens are. and you know, John Harbaugh, he gets those guys ready every Sunday, and they were ready, and they were a veteran team, and they put it to us. So you got to play a clean game against that team. We definitely did not. But on that first drive of the game, it was already 7-0 quickly, and you know, they drove down the field pretty quickly. The Dolphins did. They picked up a blitz on a 3rd and 5 in Ravens territory, and the ball came out on time. That you know, pass protection was good, and Landry was open, but on the cutback he slipped and missed, and the ball was incomplete, and they missed a field goal. So that drive gets down to the 28-yard line, and we come up with no points. The next drive, we have a 3rd and 5 again from the exact same spot, the 28-yard line, and Parker has man coverage on the outside with a single high safety in the middle of the field, and he really was late getting over. Devontae Parker beats the press, gets behind the corner, and Ladarius Webb is a pretty rangy safety, so he does get over there, but he's a tad bit late. But if Parker just elevates for the ball and has stronger hands, if you look on Twitter, I believe Sam from Welcome to Perfectville, Sam and Chris on our other the other podcast on Welcome to Perfectville, he tweeted out a picture of Devontae Parker, you know, alligator arming the ball, and he really should have caught it. So if he just has the stronger hands and comes down with that ball, you know, that's 7 more points. So
I totally agree. Like if he's ever going to become like an AJ Green type, or you know, something like that, that's a ball he's got to catch, in my opinion. What do you think about that?
Yeah, every single time. And he had a drop on a slant over the middle against, I want to say it was Cleveland earlier in the year, maybe it was somebody else, but he's had some drops like that in this season alone. And if he secures a couple of those catches, they're big plays. And
it was the Tennessee game, I think. On our first or second drive.
Okay, yeah, that sounds right. I think he caught the one in Cleveland, actually, is what I'm thinking of. But I'm with you. You know, as a guy you take in the 14th pick in the draft, you expect him to make that kind of play, and he didn't. So, and not only not to make the play, but to allow the guy to intercept it. So that's two drives where they have 0 points going to the Ravens' 28-yard line that could have been 10, possibly 14. You know, I don't want to say, you know, make too much speculation, but if Landry doesn't slip and fall and makes that catch, we could have kept driving into the red zone. And then the third drive was a shortened field when Byron Maxwell gets an interception. And, you know, like I said, this game is at least 14-10 at that point with the ball at the Ravens' 38-yard line. The first play is a 7-yard completion, which there was fantastic pass protection on the play again. And we have a 2nd and 3 at the Ravens' 31, and then Devontae Parker false starts. Jay Ajayi goes backwards 4 yards, and then we have a failed dump-off pass to Damian Williams, and then we punt. So another drive that was in scoring range that went backwards and didn't result that way. And then the 4th and final drive of the first half, on 2nd and 10, Tannehill hit Parker for 17 yards out to the 42-yard line, and he threads it into a triangle of Ravens, a perfect throw, great route, good catch, everything looked good, more good pass protection with a stunt that got picked up this time. And then the very next play, Tannehill mishandles a snap, or I think it was 2 plays later, mishandles a snap, and the drive is basically over. So that's, first drive was 8 plays for 47 yards, second drive was 9 plays for 58 yards, and then you go with the false start and the negative run that killed the third drive, and then the drop snap. So, I mean, just some critical mistakes at the most important moments. You know, getting the ball to the 28, to the 28, and the 31 of the Ravens to come away with 0 points, you're just not going to win when you have that kind of result. So did you get any of that positive vibes that I got from the rewatch, or do you still feel like it was just a kind of a crap fest all around?
No, I agree. I think the offense at least definitely played well in the first half, and it's just bad mistakes. Like, I really feel like they've got to move on from Andrew Franks, because, I mean, that's a 46-yard field goal, and if you're going to be a playoff team, you need a kicker who's reliable enough to make that, and you could tell that was going way left right as he kicked it. Like, that wasn't even close.
It was a total shank, complete shank from Franks.
I think the Chargers guy almost kicked one, like, completely to the corner in the Buccaneers-Chargers game, so it wasn't the worst miss of the day, but it was bad.
It's the worst one if you're a Dolphins fan, though, so.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think it's just unfortunate because I thought Tannehill played pretty well in the first half. You know, maybe the one bad throw he had was the pass he threw behind. I think it was Landry that got deflected and Weddle picked it off. But other than that, I thought he played a pretty good first half and they were moving the ball. I thought Ajayi played well, but I mean, you know, we didn't score a point, so it can't be all good.
Exactly. Yeah, you got to make the plays on third down in the red zone. It's kind of when this game really gets decided, especially at this level in the NFL. So, yeah, Andrew Franks, I'm ready to move on. I was against him in the preseason. I told you that on the grades episode a couple months ago. I told you I wanted that Marshall Cohen to beat him out because that Marshall Cohen from, I think it was Iowa, had measurables that ran like a wide receiver number. So I was a fan of his because of his measurables, but you know, kicking is kicking. So who really knows what the hell these guys have going through their minds. Right. It's more of a mental aspect than anything else. So, you know, Andrew Franks, the two blocked field goals from under 30 yards this year, that missed from 46. They surpassed two separate 52-yard attempts with Andrew Franks this year. So not a lot of faith there. And his kickoffs, he gets some touchbacks quite often.
He can never mortar kick it. Like, watch Gostkowski from New England. He puts it between, like, the goal line and the five every time. And they stop teams at, like, the 10 or 11.
Yeah, it's amazing.
You can't do that.
It's amazing how well some teams can do that. And like you said, Gostkowski's perfect at it. And Franks, it's either all the way through or to like the 10-yard line. So
yeah.
That's my quota on Andrew Franks. That's our quota on talking about kickers for the podcast. So moving on to the second half of the game, offensive film is when it gets really bad. I mean, that's kind of funny to say, but this team's just not built to come from behind on either side of the ball. I think you'd agree with the defense. Offensively, Ryan Tannehill really started to press in the second half. I thought the film in the first half was fine. You know, the interception wasn't on him. I thought he was making good decisions and he showed good feet. He had time in the pocket. but the passing lane started closing up in the second half as they were kind of expecting the pass and playing the pass. And they weren't there and he was getting rattled. He knew he had to make some plays and he started making some poor decisions. And the protection started to break down a little bit more. And he made some bad throws and bad decisions. But the one that you mentioned to Landry, the second interception, that's about as bad as I've seen Tannehill do this year. I mean, that's a rookie throw right there where he's kind of comes off the lead rate, the read late and comes over the middle and throws it well behind the receiver on the back shoulder. So just a terrible throw from Tannehill there and a bad day at the office for him, all things told. Brandon Albert, I thought, was pretty bad. Had a rough time with Terrell Suggs. He didn't get a lot of pressure in the first half, but he kind of had Albert on his heels and in the running game had him confused. You know, a lot of mental breakdowns from Brandon Albert. I thought Laramie Tunzel did a good job helping Steen all day, but you could tell that was the plan, was to get Tunzel to help Steen on the big nose tackles of the Ravens with Brandon Williams and Timmy Jernigan. And they pretty much did what they wanted to because Jermon Bushrod had yet another crappy game. He hasn't really had a good game since mid-October. And then Juwan James's footwork was crap in the game. There was one play where they showed, I think it was Elvis Dumervil, tossed him aside like a rag doll. Just looked horribly embarrassing. That was bad. The tight end run blocking didn't get any better. Deion Sims had a nice catch on a little leak out route on that same play action rollback that I've been raving about the past few weeks, where they dumped it off to Marquise Gray, and they added the second layer element to that, and the Ravens kind of came down on Marquise Gray at the line of scrimmage, and they dumped it over the top to Sims for a nice gain on the very first play of the game, or is the first drive. And Sims and Gray struggled with the Ravens linebackers all day, so a bad day for the tight ends as well. Receivers had bad games. Devontae Parker didn't separate well. He played slower than he normally does, I think, with even when he's slow out of his breaks. He struggled with press coverage. The first couple of drives of the game, he was the only one they pressed at times. He had the lazy hands on the INT. I thought Landry was a mess because of the field conditions. He couldn't get his footing ever, and then they started force-feeding in the second half, and his stats looked a lot better than he actually played, which is, you know, a whole nother topic. But Leonte Crew got some action in this game, and like everyone else, he can't block a screen. They try a screen early in the game, and he just kind of lets this guy go around him. And then Kenny Stills, not really anything to write home about there. Not much he did offensively either. You mentioned Jay Ajayi, Kevin, and is it just me, or does this guy have the potential to be something special? Do you think he is a potential for a top five back in the league, or is this season kind of a fluke, or how do you feel about Jay Ajayi moving forward right now?
I would say if he's not a top five back, he's probably in the next three or four. But I mean, even some of the bad games from early in the season, like the New England game, he ran pretty hard. He had a fumble. But like the Bengals game, he was about the only back that could get positive yardage. The Tennessee game, you know, he was breaking tackles like 8 yards deep in the backfield and getting positive yardage. So I think he's like the one, at this point, the one truly, I don't know if elite is the right word, but he's on the cusp of being elite player that we have. I think once Laramie Tunsil gets out to left tackle, that'll be our second elite guy on offense. But, you know, I think as of right now, pound for pound, player for player, Jay Ajayi is our best offensive player this season.
It'd be hard to disagree with you on that too. And even Terrell Suggs made it a point after the game to say that guy is special. He has a different level and a different gear. So when you get praise like that from a future Hall of Famer and big time player, that's pretty nice to see. I was super impressed with his tape too. These stats that he has that I'm going to read off here for you are ridiculous. He had 61 yards on 12 carries. 57 of those 61 yards came after contact. On the 12 carries, he broke 7 tackles. He was decisive. He got north and south quickly. His active legs made him a very tough tackle. He had one 5-yard run where he broke a tackle with a spin move in the backfield, and then is right at the mesh point, right to get the football. And then he pressed the clogged up hole in the middle and bounces it outside for a nice positive game. And he just looked awesome. I would have loved to see him get this game be closed and have him get 25 carries and really you know, pound away at the Ravens. But we never got that opportunity because the defense crapped the bed and the offense didn't do much either. So
I agree. I feel like if it had been closer or like we had had to lead at some point, I feel like he probably would have broken 100 yards on the Ravens, which is pretty tough to do. So
I don't think there's any doubt that he would have because he had 61 yards on 12 carries. That's what, 5 yards a pop. So if he just gets, you know, up to 20 carries, he's looking at 100-yard day. So I think you're absolutely right there. Damian Williams and Kenyon Drake actually shared the backfield on a shotgun play where they split the quarterback. But other than that, I didn't really, you know, make much note of them. Drake didn't really flash, and Williams had one pass reception where he lined up outside on a linebacker, and he cut inside for a little dig route and made a catch and a first down. I think that's something that we should see more of if he gets those linebackers on the outside. You know, he had the touchdown catch in San Diego in a similar situation. I think that anytime they see him out there, they want to give him the ball, and it's a good idea. And then that's pretty much it for the players. The play calling, you know, I didn't think the play calling was the issue in this game. I think it's easy to blame the coaching staff. It's an easy cop-out. And you have to expect, you know, these guys that are making these big bucks to execute every once in a while. So even after the game at his press conference, Adam Gase, you know, he said the execution was a problem on both sides of the ball. And he was very, very adamant about execution and the lack of it. And he's a guy that's kind of always been open and honest with us, you know, in those press conferences. So I think it's, you kind of got to take him for his word there because he's always been honest with you. So I will take his word for that. And the film backs it up too because the execution was pretty crappy. And on the Welcome to Perfectville podcast today, that's actually came out on Tuesday morning. Chris and Sam did their podcast, and Chris was very adamant about Adam Gase having, you know, a bad day at the office. And one of the plays that he mentioned was a 2-point conversion play, the 1 2-point conversion play we ran to Jarvis Landry. And if you look at it, it's actually the same one they ran against Buffalo, where he kind of runs a little curl route to the corner of the end zone or the front pylon across the goal line. And I guarantee you that play is designed to go into the end zone because there's no way I can imagine him calling that play short. And Landry likes to leap up for it and kind of come forward and then tries to get back into the end zone where he just needs to kind of catch it and fall back in. And I know that you're supposed to come back to the football, but the way that route is designed is to get it stuck on him and fall into the end zone. So I think he cut the route short. I think it's on Jarvis Landry. And I think that they need to, you know, execute better as the play, but rather than blaming the play calling. So
yeah, it's an interesting play call though, too, because if you remember the Buffalo game, Tannehill got some pressure and kind of lollipopped it up there, and Landry caught it and basically put the ball on his left hand and outstretched over the goal line to make it into the end zone. So I don't know. I think there's got to be something coming off of that, and I'm actually going to drop a pre-memberberry on you. If you go all the way back to, I think it was Tannehill's rookie year, 2012, we played Jacksonville at home and beat them like 24-10. But in that game, we ran a similar play, and they had Anthony Fasano basically do a delayed drag across the formation, and Tannehill threw it all the way to the backside on a 2-point conversion. So it wouldn't surprise me if we have that situation come up again where there's some sort of throwback or delayed route, almost like what we saw with Chip Kelly in the 49ers run for that touchdown to Celek last week. So I don't know. That's my prediction for the future if we're ever in a 2-point situation again.
I think it's a great point, and I think that you're absolutely right because Adam Gase has proven in the past that he will add layers to plays that he's shown previously, like the play-action rollback that I mentioned to Marquise Gray. You know, adding the Deion Sims element there to the second level was a good look there and taking advantage of what might have been on tape previously. And I agree with you that the Buffalo play was a poor throw where he kind of popped it up because Landry had the pylon all to himself if he just would have thrown a dart and got him into the end zone on his own. So totally with you on that idea. That the first throw was a bad one, and then this one just, I don't know. It seemed like the pressure came into his face, like you said, again. So, but I mean, I will fight tooth and nail that play is supposed to go to the end zone. There's no way he's supposed to run that route short. So, I thought the plan was good. The intermediate passing game worked really well early, and they were clearly not as well prepared for the playing surface as the Ravens were, in my opinion. I think they had to scrap a lot of things they wanted to do when the score got out of hand. You know, like I mentioned, the Ravens, I think they had a better idea of what the field conditions were going to be like than the Dolphins because the Dolphins game plan had some quick cut routes where they came back to the football and the Ravens ran a lot more drags and seams and things that were just keeping the receiver going in the same direction. So they didn't have as many slipping issues as we did. I know Adam Gase wasn't happy about it. Obviously the field doesn't have, you know, a 32-point difference on the outcome of the game, but it was a factor. So all things told, it was a horrible day from the offense. There's no doubt about that. It's got to be a lot better. But I am at least encouraged by what I saw on film, at least in the first half. But the defense, Kevin, I'm pretty worried about that side. And I don't see any reason for optimism. And that's why I'm kind of hoping I can turn to you here. Were you able to calm some of your fears with the film review, or was it just as bad as I thought?
Yes and no, but I think first things first, we got to give our grade for Tannehill, and I was almost inclined to give it an incomplete or not applicable, because that was just, you know, it was off the rails from the beginning because of the defense, so I don't even know if I want to give him a check or a non-check for that, so I may just throw that game away. What about you?
That's fair. I mean, I had him down for a no, you know, not checking the box. I think that's probably pretty easy to say, but
yeah.
Like I said, he's not built to run an offense like that where you got to come from behind, and he's not going to do the Andrew Luck in the playoffs against the Chiefs a few years back when he comes back from 35 down or whatever that was. So
right.
I'm going to stick with no check mark and actually call it a negative game for him, just because he had opportunities in the first half, and I know guys didn't make plays for him, but they had opportunities and didn't make it happen. So no check mark for me this week.
I gotcha. Well, I guess to start with the defense, you know, I doubt Vance Joseph listens to this, but, you know, he should basically take the game plan, you know, just rip it up, crumple it, throw it away. You know, when you give up 38 points and none of that comes by way of a pick six or a fumble return or a special teams return, you had a bad day at the offense. And just listen to some of these stats. Miami gave up 38 points, 496 yards of offense. They gave up 28 first downs, two of which were on fourth down conversions. The Ravens were 2 for 2 on fourth down. Surprisingly, Miami held them under 50% on third down. I found that hard to believe, but the Ravens only had 11 third downs. So, it's just bad all around on Miami's defensive part. And, you know, give credit where credit is due. Baltimore came up with a game plan that we saw that was basically exactly the same as what the Patriots threw at us back in week 2. You know, 3-step drops, maybe 1 or 2 5-step drops. It was all short passing. It was all, you know, call them whatever you want, option routes, choice routes, you know, quick reads, and they spread Miami out horizontally. So it basically got Miami in nickel personnel for most of the game. And, you know, with Jelani Jenkins out, about the one thing he does is he actually is kind of dependable, dropping into the hook and the curl zones and getting to the flat, and he's got some speed to him. So credit him for that. But, you know, Joe Flacco just made Kiko Alonso and Spencer Paysinger his bitches all day long. just wasn't pretty. Overall, I thought they looked tired. The D-line couldn't get anywhere near them. And I think part of that reason is because Andre Branch and Dominican Sue and Cameron Wake have had to eat a ton of snaps over the last 2 weeks, especially last week against San Francisco. And I think that's been magnified because Jason Jones had to serve that 2-game suspension. So he'll be back fresh this week, hopefully. And then Mario Williams got dinged up against the Rams and didn't play in the second half. And then he got sick in the 49ers game. So I think that's kind of hurt. And you kind of saw it. Andre Branch basically got his ass handed to him by Ronnie Stanley, who's a rookie, all day long. You know, Cameron Wake got doubled most of the day. Couldn't really do anything. Really, the only time he got pressures was when Flacco broke out of the pocket, just trying to make something happen. You know, to me, it seemed like the whole game plan, Miami was very afraid of the abilities of Mike Wallace and Steve Smith and Breshad Perriman to go deep. They played a lot more cover 4, a lot more 2-man with deep safeties than they have all year long. And then they had Kiko Alonso, Spencer Paysinger, Bakari Rambo basically trying to read those short zones and acting as robbers underneath. All three of them were just a step slow, and then Alonso broke his thumb in the game. I think all the way around, that was just a bad call, really bad day. Probably Vance Joseph's worst game plan, and the fact that he's had 2 bad ones in back-to-back weeks is concerning to me. You know, Joe Flacco played probably the best I've ever seen, just getting it out there. I think I saw a chart someone posted out after the game where he only had 1 completion that traveled more than 10 yards downfield.
Yeah.
And I think he had 2 throws that were more than 15 yards downfield. One was a completion, and the other one was the Maxwell interception, which was actually a good play by Bobby McCain to basically undercut that route, and he had to sail it.
Yeah, Kevin, I wanted to ask you about the throw chart there and Joe Flacco a little bit, and you mentioned the pass rushers. And upon rewatching the defense on the broadcast version of the game, for me, it looked like, you know, the pass rushers didn't get there at all, but was that just because the ball's coming out so quickly? Because I thought that Flacco only took a few 7-step drops in the game. And even the first couple of series, I thought there was a couple of plays where the pass rush looked like it was about to get there, but then the ball came out just in time before it did. And then they pretty much went to 3-step drops and quick throws. Was that kind of what you saw too?
Yeah, I think it's kind of the nature of the wide 9, just because you're lining up the ends. you know, further away from the quarterback's launch point to get him those angles. So when you're running these three-step drops, it's really tough for them to actually engage a tackle, get past him, and get to the quarterback, especially when the ball's coming out that quick. And, you know, just I think Baltimore played a perfect game plan with a lot of slice routes, slant routes, and then they seemingly always had a third guy or a tight end, you know, just running a little hook and sitting down in the zone over the middle. And Miami was basically playing cover four out of a nickel and, you know, with two men with two high safeties. So the middle was just open all day long. You know, Rich Gannon just, you know, ad nauseum, just hit that point over and over again. Yeah, I mean, they just did not have a good day. You know, I'm just watching some of those plays, like Earl Mitchell got dominated by Marshall Yanda a couple times. Jordan Phillips did as well. Sue got doubled pretty much the whole day. You know, just it was a great plan by the Ravens. I'll give them credit, you know. But I thought, like, Tony Lippett probably had his worst game of the season. You know, Bakari Rambo just looked slow out there. You know, one of the things I noticed is on that first fourth down and one conversion, there's nobody outside of Andre Branch at right end. And it's fourth and one, mind you. And Tony Lippett is 12 yards off of Steve Smith to that side of the field. Like, that's just – that's incredibly bad, you know, in that situation. Like, the situational awareness that – I don't know if that's a call that Vance Joseph has or if Lippett's not comfortable playing up on press against Steve Smith. But, you know, he's got to be the support player there, and he's 12 yards down the field. That play was a gimme right from the start. And, you know, when you're down 24 to nothing – you know, it's just, it's tough to kind of review that. I didn't even watch the second half the second time around, you know, in the review. Just some of the quick notes I had, you know, Andre Branch, I thought he played the run okay, but Ronnie Stanley basically took his lunch money and pass protection. And, you know, it's been rumored that Miami's going to try and re-sign him. And I think if they do, it better be at a pretty friendly team rate, because even though he's played a lot better than I thought he would, he's still kind of one-dimensional. You know, his pass rush moves are either a bull rush and a long arm, and he's just not big and strong enough to make those work consistently. Neville Hewitt and Spencer Paysinger, you know, two guys I think I've talked about on the podcast before that should never be in pass coverage, and because of injuries, they both were at times during the day, and, you know, I think you kind of showed why they should only be special teams players. Mike Hull, I think he had two nice flash plays. He made a really nice stop against the run, but I mean, in terms of being an NFL middle linebacker, that's kind of run-of-the-mill stuff. That's what you're supposed to do. You know, it's just one of those things. I thought Abdul Kaddous, you know, he looked a step slow. I don't know if it was players not wearing the right cleats or the surface or whatever. But Abdul Kaddous probably had his worst game since that Patriots game. Really, the only player I was really impressed with was Byron Maxwell. And I think you can make the case he's been their best player in the secondary this year just because Rashad Jones has been out. I don't know, Travis, what do you think about that?
He certainly has come on since that Pittsburgh game when he locked up Antonio Brown, and I kind of gave him some crap for the performance against Brandon Marshall, but, you know, holding him to the 60 yards, whatever it was, with all the penalties included, and you just haven't heard much from him lately. So yeah, I'm with you. I think he's really picked it up. Not sure he's earned that contract, you know, the size of that contract for next year. We'll see. It'll be really interesting to see what they do with, you know, Xavien Howard, Tony Lippett, Byron Maxwell, Bobby McCain all being on the roster, with the other three having really small contracts and Maxwell having the big one. But yeah, I think you're spot on. He's definitely the best corner in the secondary. And I would say Issa Abdul-Kaddous is probably the next closest challenger.
Yeah. So back to your original question, you know, how did I feel about it? I think in terms of the short term, like the small picture, I'm pretty shaky at best because, you know, the very next opponent we have, Arizona, they can run that quick passing game just the same. If that New England game means something at the end of the season, you know, they'll probably run it exactly the same way. Plus, they'll have Tom Brady back. So I don't really feel good about that. I think the silver lining I took from the game is seeing that performance, it really just highlights the needs that Miami has on defense. And they really need to have a defensive-heavy offseason. They really haven't had a defensive-heavy draft since 2010, and I think it's high time that happens. You know, I think overall on the day, Branch and Wake were kind of burned out from having to play a ton of those snaps. I think the way Miami kind of counters this moving forward, you know, if you're going to have to rely on Alonzo and Jenkins and guys like that, they need to play more press man on the perimeter. and not let these quick routes develop, you know, at least gives the pass rush a chance. I didn't think Miami was aggressive enough at all versus Baltimore, which is kind of surprising because when Vance Joseph was in Cincinnati, the Bengals won all four games that they played against the Ravens. So obviously he didn't carry over most of that game plan. I thought they didn't really have that fast athletic player underneath as a robber. You know, you could use Rashad Jones for that. You could use Issa Abdul-Kaddous in that role if you had Rashad Jones' athleticism over the top. So I didn't really think, you know, they'd had bad personnel matchups with the injuries they had sustained, and I think the D-line was burned out. Hopefully getting Mario Williams back and Jason Jones back this week, I think they'll be able to expose Arizona's tackles. You know, I watched a little bit of their game today against Washington, and they have Ulrich John. I don't know if you guys remember him. He was in camp with us and played it for us some last year when we had a bunch of injuries. Cameron Wake should have at least two or three sacks. But I guess to sum up the defensive review, I think overall big picture, it's too soon to tell whether the scheme is the problem or Vance Joseph is the problem. I want to give him the benefit of the doubt and give him a full offseason of getting guys in the draft and free agency. You know, I think, you know, they need two capable starting caliber defensive ends acquired. I think they need two starting capable linebackers to help him out. And I think if it's still poor after that, then I think you kind of question Vance Joseph. That's my defensive review. Travis, any follow-up on the review for the defensive side of the ball tonight?
Well, it is funny you mentioned Ulrich John, because I think the Perfectville guys, Chris and Sam, back in training camp in the preseason games, I'm pretty sure they called him John Ulrich multiple times over and over again, because that's, you know, that's what you would think his name would be. But no, Ulrich John is his actual name, first name Ulrich. I do remember him. He was pretty awful in preseason games against, you know, future grocery backers. So it's pretty awesome to see that we'll have a chance to have Cam Wake, you know, collapse on him in that right side of the offensive line. But no, it pretty much confirms what my fears were, Kevin, that this defense has a lot of work to go and a lot of, you know, a lot of ground to make up in terms of getting back to where they were with the injuries mounting up a little bit. So a little bit nervous about that side of the ball. We will get into that Ravens preview here briefly, but yeah, that's pretty much all I have. I do want to make one quick edit to the podcast outline here. I just got a tweet from one of my favorite Twitter followers of mine that he kind of responds back and forth with me. His name is Corey Ashburn at Corhay, at Corhayy 13. So Corhay 13. He asked me how many snaps Leonte Carew played and how he looked. And I had just trashed on Leonte Carew for his screen blocking abilities. So that's one thing for you, Corey. I looked at the snaps just now. He did get 10 snaps in the game on Sunday. And me and Kevin talked about this. We weren't going to go over the snap counts today because we just kind of thought it was irrelevant. But I'm looking at him now. It is kind of interesting if you look at it, because Kenny Stills played all 62 snaps at receiver. Landry played 61. And then Parker was 49. Leonte Carew was 10. And then Jakeem Grant had 4. And then the tight ends is very interesting. Deion Sims had 60. Marquise Gray had 3. And Dominic Jones had 2. I want to check the accuracy on that, because I don't know. I feel like Gray was out there for a lot more than that, but that's what I'm reading here on the site that I usually use for my snap counts. So that's footballguys.com. So I think a lot of the offensive game plan, like I mentioned earlier, was altered because of the, you know, the gradual decline of the game, if you will, and kind of the route that it took, and how the Dolphins had to come play from behind and play a lot of more, you know, 13 personnel with one tight end and 3 receivers. So yeah, Leonte Carew had 10 snaps, another kind of goose egg for me in terms of production. He didn't get any catches, and he just was out there kind of running against air and not really doing much. So I'd like to see more from him, Corey. I think Kevin probably would too. How do you feel about Leonte Carew so far, Kevin?
I think he's had a tough job. I know Adam Gase mentioned it a couple weeks ago where, you know, he's basically had to learn all 3 of the different wide receiver positions because they don't really have, you know, a true backup at that point. You know, I mean, they paid 2 draft picks to move up and get him, so it'd be nice to see him produce a little bit. I thought he's played well on special teams, but I mean, you know, just the snap count opportunities haven't really been there, just because Stills and Landry and Parker have all been relatively healthy throughout the season. So I guess we'll find out more about him next year.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with him and Kenny Stills, or with Kenny Stills' contract, and see if Leonte Carew can take that over. I think you're right about him learning the different positions. Pretty tough for a rookie to do. He had the start in Seattle when Parker was out, and then this game he saw a few more snaps, but not much else from Carew. Let's get to the next segment here, Kevin. That game is over with now. We can put it in the past. They got smoked by the Ravens. We're now 7-5, and we are still in the seventh position of the AFC playoffs. Actually, just one game back of the Denver Broncos, and the Steelers are also 7-5 with us, tied for seventh, but we have that tiebreaker there. So we're still right in it, still hopefully can make some noise here in December and kind of exercise some of those demons of December's past, especially in the AFC East.
Denver's got a pretty brutal schedule down the stretch, too. So
it's very brutal. We will get to them at the playoff segment. Right now, I want you to kind of catch us up on some of the roster transactions or roster notes, if you will.
Yeah, as far as everything I checked out today, nothing really new. We knew Kiko Alonso broke his thumb. broke his thumb on his right hand in the Ravens game, had surgery Monday. Sounds like he's hopeful that he'll be able to play Sunday. I guess we'll see. I watched a little bit of Adam Gase's media availability today. He's supposed to be meeting with Mike Pouncey and some of Pouncey's doctors tonight. So he said he would have an update for people on Wednesday if Pouncey would be able to play this week. Or I think originally they said it could be up to 4 weeks, which would be the Jets game on the 17th. So, but really no other transactions other than Mike Cole would be the starter in place of Kiko Alonso if Kiko can't go on Sunday.
Mike Cole, and as Chris and Sam like to say on the Welcome to Perfectville podcast, and please be sure to check out welcometoperfectville.com. You can check out their podcast there. You can check out our podcast there. The entire catalog is up there for the Finalysis podcast. Also, the Write Travis Write blog portion, the blog of Welcome to Perfectville. And I believe Kevin's actually going to start writing for us here in the near future. In the near future, you know, a piece a week or maybe every other week or something like that. So keep your eye out for that. You can see us all on Twitter. Our information is all in the information of this post, whether or not you're looking at it on iTunes or on the Finalysis podcast on welcometoperfectville.com. You'll find the information there. So that brings me back, Kevin.
I guess I can let the cat out of the bag. So the first article should be out early next week. I've had a few questions come at me about the wide nine defense, asking if I could explain it more in depth. So I think I'll just do a breakdown of that just to kind of piece it together. So check out the Perfectville website early next week for that coming out.
That's awesome. I didn't even know that. So he broke the news to me just now and broke the news to you guys. And Kevin is a bit of a whiz when it comes to that. If you listened to the show previously, I think episode 4 or 5, we talked about, or maybe it was even one of the first couple episodes. I don't even know. That was a while ago. But one of the first few episodes, we talked about the origins of the wide nine, and I kind of talked about Adam Gase's offense. But Kevin gave a sterling breakdown of the wide nine defense, so he knows his stuff. Be sure to check that out, welcometoperfectville.com, on the blog portion there for us. So that's enough for fluffing our own site. Let's get to the next segment, which is one that's been a recurring segment lately.
Oh, I remember.
I love Bionic Man. Remember Chewbacca again? Oh, I love to remember Chewbacca.
We love to remember past Dolphins on this show as well. And today we're remembering member berries. I don't even know how to say that anymore. Member berries today for me is Greg Camarillo. I figured it was kind of fitting with the Baltimore game, even though it wasn't exactly the same result. You know, he had the winner against Baltimore on that 1-15 season, the overtime catch and run for 60 yards from Cleo Lemon. And I had another quote that I remember today when they played the Broncos the following year. Played the Broncos when they won the division, and it was a big game. We won the game late in the fourth quarter, and I can't remember the name of the cornerback that was covering him, but Camarillo had something like 11 catches for 110 yards. And the corner said, well, they asked him about it after the game. He said, well, yeah, what was his longest catch? 10 yards. And I was thinking like, well, yeah, that's okay for one catch, but when he does it on you 11 times, I think you're kind of getting beat on the day. So Greg Camarillo had an awesome 2008 season before he tore his ACL in a game that I was at against the Patriots and never came back to the Dolphins after that again. So Greg Camarillo was my Mary Berry for the day. Kevin, who is yours?
Yeah, I think your corner you were looking for was Dominique Foxworth.
That's the one.
Right. But my member Barry is actually a sad one. It's my 14th birthday on January 15th, 2000. Most of you probably know that date as Dan Marino's last game. We lost to Jacksonville 62-7. We were down 41-7 at halftime. Fred Taylor broke the game open with an 80-yard run for a touchdown on the first play. That's kind of how I felt watching the first two drives that the Ravens had. I kind of knew the game was over. I kind of made the comparison. Watching the Ravens game was like death by 1,000 needles, and the Jacksonville game was pretty much just a straight beheading. long story short, neither of those are good. So I'm sorry for the downer on the member berries today.
You gotta keep the mood consistent here, and that's kind of how it was on Sunday, carrying over into the week. I'm starting to get over it a little bit more here, but I'm still pretty bummed out about it as well. And you mentioned the 62-7 thrashing from that week, and how bad the entire team was, the offensive line in particular, I thought, in that game, as well as this game. They didn't play their best game either. So offensive line, that kind of brings me to the next point we were going to talk about with Mike Pouncey, Kevin, and kind of his impact on the entire offensive line. He makes $10.25 million this year, so $10.25 million this year. And if he doesn't come back and play anymore, that means he's only played four games for the year. So that gives him about $2.5 million per game he's making to, you know, play four games. And Anthony Steens is back up. He's played okay. He's not Mike Pouncey athletically. He's just not the same player. And then you look at Brandon Albert at left tackle, and he's got his injury problems, and he hasn't played a full season in forever since he's been here even. And Laramie Tunzel's ready to take over left tackle position. So I'm thinking if Pouncey is, you know, relieved of his duties, I don't think he will be, but if he is because of the injury history, and Brandon Albert moves on because of that big contract, and Laramie Tunzel can kick outside and play left tackle, that immediately opens up three openings on the interior of the offensive line, because Jermon Bushrod, I cannot imagine he'll be starting next year for this team. Maybe as a sixth lineman he can come back, but not starting for this team. So what do you think the future of this offensive line is? Are they going to keep Pouncey around? Are they going to keep Albert? Is Tunzel going to play left guard for another year? Do you think this line can be fixed in one offseason?
I guess here's my take on it. I think someone had told me that Pouncey's injury is pretty similar to the same injury that Alex Rodriguez had in baseball. So I guess we'll know a little bit more tomorrow when Gase meets with the media. But my thinking is if he can figure out what's wrong with it this offseason, I think he's shown just how damn good he is, especially in this scheme when he's played. So I'm not ready to give up on him there. Maybe you can get him to do like a restructure of his contract or something. To mitigate some of those expenses, especially this year. But Pouncey, I would keep 100% unless for some reason he like retires or has some catastrophic problem with his hips that we don't know about. Maybe we can get Shakira in there and see what she thinks. But as far as Brandon Albert goes, I think his contract is actually under $10 million a year. I guess I would like to keep him at this point just because that's one more hole you have to fill if you move Tunzel out there. I think for me, though, the biggest thing for me would be is if you can keep Albert and Pouncey, maybe you go after one big free agent. And I think living here in Cincinnati, I've seen this guy play with the Bengals. Kevin Zeitler is a fantastic right guard for them. I think he would be a great fit in this scheme. He's big, he's nasty, he can actually move pretty well for someone who's 315 pounds. So he'd be my number one free agent to go out and sign from another team this offseason, even on either side of the ball. And I think Larry Warford, the guard for Detroit, would probably be a close second. But if you do decide to move on from one of the two between Albert and Pouncey, I would say Albert, just because you have a ready-made replacement there. And if you did do that and still sign Zeitler, I think if Pat Elflein slips to your pick in round one or two, the center slash guard out of Ohio State, just take him fresh out of the box. He can be your starter at guard or center. I don't think Anthony Steen is anything more than a backup at this point. And honestly, I wouldn't even trust him to play guard. For a big guy, he gets pushed around an awful lot in the NFL.
Yeah, I'm with you on all that. I think it's hard to say on Pouncey because he just I like it when he's out there. I get so sick of seeing him out there. And like you mentioned, Shakira and her hips, and his hips are lying right now because that's a serious injury you're talking about. And if he can't come back from that anytime soon, that contract is just not going to work out. And so the restructure is probably the best option you have there. But it's, I don't know, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the offseason. It'll be interesting to see what happens the rest of the season to see if he comes back and plays at all this year and if he's healthy when he plays this year. So it's a situation that definitely bears monitoring. But let's move forward, Kevin. Let's get to this Arizona game we have coming up because...
So, by the way, like, am I totally off base with the Shakira reference? Maybe that's one for Chris and Sam, but I just realized that she hasn't really made a record in, like, I don't know, 10 years.
You're talking to the wrong guy when it comes to pop music, my friend. I'm not really sure at all. I know she's, you know, smoking hot and has the hips that don't lie. But other than that, that's all my Shakira knowledge goes to, or as far as my Shakira knowledge goes, I should say. But
gotcha.
You know, speaking of those Arizona Cardinals, we talked about a little bit earlier in the show. You know, I saw a stat today. The Dolphins have the 25th ranked defense in the NFL and the 25th ranked offense, and the Cardinals have the 2nd ranked defense and the 9th ranked offense. Now that's yards per game, which I don't think is always the most telling stat, but it is what it is, and we're, you know, a better record than the Cardinals, but much worse than them in terms of moving the football up and down the field from a yardage standpoint. So that's something we definitely have to you know, keep in mind and look forward to. But can you tell me something about the Arizona defense? Because I looked at their offense, and it was one of the most dominant units in the league last year, and they're not quite there this year, but I think they could be a sleeping giant. But tell me about their defense a little bit.
Yeah, so defensively, you know, it just seems like Miami's had to play a bunch of good defenses in a row other than the 49ers, and the 49ers probably rolled their best game of the year against Miami, but it's another 3-4 defense. They run that kind of hybrid look with Dion Buchanan playing sort of one of the inside linebacker spots. Very blitz heavy. They get after the passer. They've got 31 sacks. However, 15 of those have come from two guys. Chandler Jones has 8. Marcus Golden has 7. So that's on Brandon Albert and Juwan James to stop those guys. Calais Campbell is pretty beastly in the middle. He'll probably be up against Tunsil most of the game. Campbell has 4 sacks himself. Their run defense, I think, is where we might be able to take advantage of. They're ranked 12th. They give up 98 yards per game. But having watched the Redskins game, you know, I don't even remember the two running backs' names for the Redskins, like Chris Thompson and some other guy, something Kelly.
Robert Kelly. Fat Robert Kelly is what they call him.
R. Kelly? Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think those guys were supposed to be the starters going into camp, but they got 87 yards against Arizona last week on a 4.8 average. So, you know, if Miami's O-line comes in healthy, and especially if we get Pouncey back, I think the J-Train will have a good day. They're very good in the secondary, 3rd in the league against the pass. They give up under 200 yards per game. Washington threw for 271 yards against them. The other guy that you have to watch out for is Kevin Minter. He's a pretty good blitzer, has 3 sacks. Just watching that game, I would stay away from Patrick Peterson and Tony Jefferson. They're usually on the left side of the defense, so would be the right side for Ryan Tannehill. I wouldn't even test them because those two are really good. Marcus Cooper, their right cornerback, so on the left side of the Miami offense, he got picked on all day by Kirk Cousins. I would just do the same thing. And then Tyrann Mathieu, the Honey Badger, did not play against him. I don't know what the deal was there, so maybe that's something to watch for during the week. As far as their run defense, just some quick notes I had. Marcus Golden, much like Cameron Wake, he gets too far upfield sometimes, and he can get too far inside and washed out. So I think if Miami gets him in nickel personnel, we can run on him all day long. That said, if we have to pass a lot, Tannehill's going to have at least 2 or 3, maybe more passes knocked down at the line. Arizona's got a bunch of big, long guys up front. They got 2 passes knocked down in the first 2 drives against the Redskins. They're a very aggressive front, so if by some miracle we can run a screen effectively, that might help, or get the ball out of the backfield to Ajay and Williams and Drake. I think you can take advantage of them there. For as much praise as Dion Buchanan gets, you can absolutely run at him all day. You know, Washington had their way with him. Brandon Scherff, I thought, decapitated him 2 or 3 times. He's just not very good against the run unless he can shoot his gap fast enough. Then he can give you some problems, so you know, maybe Jermon Bushrod will have a bounce back game. And then I think another guy you can target in the pass game is Tyvon Branch. He's a big hitter, nickel safety, you know, plays the run well, but is a liability in coverage. So I think if we can get the J train cranked up, it'll be a good day for the Miami offense. But that's what I saw out of their defense.
Yeah, you're definitely on the right track, especially that secondary, the Cardinals. But there is some good news in terms of the Cardinals' injury woes, if you will. And I'm looking at their snap counts now, and they came back into the game. But watching that game, Tony Jefferson left the game with an injury and came back. He only missed one snap, but he missed some time with an injury. We'll see what, you know, what happens with that moving forward. Same thing for DJ Swearinger. He got knocked down. And I don't know if it was a concussion protocol type of situation, but he was down for a minute. And then Tyvon Branch also got banged up in that game. So they had 3 guys that got hurt in the secondary. They all came back. And then, like you mentioned, Tyrann Mathieu was out for the game, and he's been kind of an, you know, our Mike Pouncey, if you will, a great player that just can't stay healthy. So that is something to keep in mind throughout the week. And I know we do the show on Tuesday nights, and it comes out on Wednesday morning, so the injury report will progress throughout the week. So that could be something that bodes definitely well in the Dolphins' favor. But as for the Arizona offense now, you know, Adam Gase talked about how the Ravens were a spacing offense and how they kind of stretched you thin across the, you know, horizontally on the field, and the way your linebackers and your defense has to play in a string that kind of moves together like a foosball table almost, and they didn't do that very well. Well, the Cardinals do the same thing, and they'll spread you out very wide. They line up their perimeter receivers beyond the numbers sometimes, which is usually like kind of taboo in the NFL or in football. Usually the numbers are where you kind of look at to line up, or inside them or just outside them, but they spread them out very wide outside the numbers on the perimeter. They will motion formation and shift you to death. Arians loves to have pre-snap movement. He has a pretty firm grasp on the offense, and Carson Palmer is an extension of that. They're both very smart football guys, so look for them to kind of try to exploit some of the same things that the Ravens did. They really focus on just two guys in the offense, which is strange because last year they had five or six quality contributors. When you think about John Brown, Jerron Brown, two different guys, John Brown and Jerron Brown, and then Michael Floyd, and then, you know, Chris Johnson was in the mix. But this year it's Larry Fitzgerald and David Johnson. David Johnson, if you ask me, is the best back in football. He's just a phenomenal player. He could break the all-time yards from scrimmage record this year. And I think if you put him in the slot as a receiver, he could be a top 10 to 15 slot guy too. So just a phenomenal athlete and player. And then Larry Fitzgerald, y'all know about him. He just gets it done. He gets upfield quickly when he catches the ball. You have to wrap him up right away because he will get upfield and he'll gain a lot of yards after the catch if you don't. Just a savvy veteran slot receiver for the Cardinals at this point in his career. Their offensive line, you mentioned it earlier, is really bad. Like, really, really bad. That's kind of been the reason the offense has been slowed this year. That and the lack of contributions from Michael Floyd and the two Browns at receiver, as well as J.J. Nelson, who takes the top off of defense too, but he hasn't done as much of that this year as he did last year. So,
is one of those guys out for the season at this point now too?
I think John Brown is the one that's out for the year, but yeah. Those guys were all contributing last year, and now they just have two of them really doing a lot. Michael Floyd's been dinged up too, so... But the offensive lineman, that's where you got to get after these guys. They're going to try to mitigate it with bubble screens and tailback screens and get David Johnson involved in the passing game there. And they run a lot of these stretch plays to get the linebackers and D-line off balance with misdirection. But it's all kind of a facade to kind of mask up that bad offensive line. So, I mean, they want to be a shot play offense. They want to go deep, but they just haven't been capable with yet bad offensive line play. So, if you know, they're going to use the middle of the field like the Ravens did. They're going to check it down, throw it to Fitzgerald underneath and in the slot, and the same thing to David Johnson. If they do set up for any deep shots, I think that's when our four-man rush has to get it done. Like you said, you know, Cam Wick needs to get two or three sacks in this game and maybe force a fumble or two. Needs to get the pressure on there and cause some of the bad decisions that Carson Palmer, let's face it, he's prone to some bad decisions and some completely, you know, horrendous games like the NFC Championship game last year in Carolina where he had, I think it was six turnovers in that game. So he's capable of just the horrendous game. He will make a couple of bad decisions and bad throws, and we have to capitalize on those plays this Sunday. Otherwise, it's going to be a long day. So, terrified of David Johnson, pretty scared of Larry Fitzgerald. But the good note that Sam mentioned today on the podcast that I have been talking about all week, I've posted on the forums, on Reddit, on the Fins, and you know, Twitter, anywhere I can. If you guys follow me on Twitter, I like to kind of give you some nuggets throughout the week. And this is one that I put on there today. Is that the Cardinals over the last 2 years are 1-6 on the East Coast. The one win was a Sunday night game last year in Philadelphia, so it wasn't the early game, it was a late game. And 0-4 in the early time slot. The other loss that wasn't in the early time slot was that NFC Championship game at nighttime in Carolina where they got the doors blown off them. And this year they're 0-3 in East Coast games in Buffalo, Atlanta, and Carolina. And in those three games, they're outscored 101-57, so almost getting doubled up. And even those 57 points they scored, were a lot of those were garbage time points that just made the score look better at the end. So I am so conflicted on this game, Kevin. I really don't know how I want to go with it because I think that they match up with us well on the field, but you just don't know what team you're going to get coming out to the East Coast. So I'm going to let you make your prediction first in this game.
Okay, well, now that the spotlight's on, I noticed an odd trend with Miami at home. Most of their games are usually right around 30 points to low 20s. You know, they had 30-24 over Cleveland, 30-15 over Pittsburgh, 27-23 over the Jets, 28-25 against Buffalo, 31-24 against San Francisco. So keeping with that and the fact that Miami just, they never have an opponent lay down for them other than maybe the San Diego game in 2014, I'm going to say 30-23 Dolphins. I think the J-Train cranks it out just enough to get a win.
Hearing you predict a win makes me feel a lot better because usually I feel like I'm the optimist of the show, kind of like how Chris is the optimist on the Welcome to Perfect Field podcast, where Sam's always predicting losses and Chris is always up there for the wins. So I feel better about that, although I'm going to go against you this week. I'm so used to this movie. I've seen it too many times before, because if we win this game, I feel like the Jets are up next, and the Jets, like you mentioned, teams don't lay down, but the Jets have pretty much punted on the season. So I feel like if we win this game, we're going to be 9-5 going into Buffalo with a chance to maybe even clinch in week 16. I don't know. It's getting ahead of ourselves, but I can't.
Like watching the wrong movie, because I feel like we'll beat Arizona and it'll be like our win over the Patriots in 2013 and then we'll collapse.
That's a bad movie. I don't want to see that movie. That is a Michael Bay movie that just has a lot of loud noises and annoying, you know, graphics on it. So I don't really want to see that movie anymore, but I'm going to go with Arizona winning 27-20 in this game with something late happening that decides the game, whether it's a interception from, you know, Ryan Tannehill that ends it into the end zone to tie the game, or Carson Palmer, you know, leading the Cardinals for a game winning touchdown, something late that ends the game for the Dolphins in a bad way and breaks our heart. So 27-20, you're going 30-23 in favor of the home team. And if that is the case, if you're right, that puts us in great spot for the playoffs, like we mentioned. And that brings us into our next segment. I love that one every time. Playoffs from Jim Mora, the remix on YouTube. Just a phenomenal video. We're talking about playoffs again. It's been something we've been talking about for a while now, pretty much since, for me, pretty much since they beat Buffalo, because I knew that the Jets, Chargers, and Rams and Niners games were winnable forward, looking ahead from those, from that point forward. So I've been thinking playoffs pretty much since we were 3-4. And, you know, now that we're 7-5 and we're back on the outside looking in, but we do have a chance to get back in. And I think for me, Kevin, it boils down to what the Broncos do, because, you know, the Broncos are sitting at 8-4 right now, a game ahead of us, and they have games, excuse me, they play at Tennessee, home for the Patriots, at Kansas City, and home for the Raiders. And I don't know if you had a chance to watch Paxton Lynch on Sunday against Jacksonville, but they had 11 punts in that game and one touchdown drive and two field goal drives. And one of the touchdowns they scored came off of pick six, so the offense didn't score the ball there. And then one of the field goals came off of another turnover. So short fields are giving them touchdowns. And that's 25 drives this year for Paxton Lynch, and they scored 20 offensive points in those 25 drives. So if Trevor Siemian can't get back, and he's not even that good of a player either, but if he can't get back, I have no faith in that Broncos team to do much for him.
I follow one of the Denver beat writers, and it sounds like Siemian, he may be able to play this week against Tennessee, but he should definitely be back for the Patriots game. I think the one thing that leads me to think they may lose this week to Tennessee is they haven't stopped the run as well as they did last year, and Tennessee runs the ball just about as well as anybody, and they've had a bye week to game plan for this one, and Tennessee's in the thick of it, especially with Indianapolis winning. Both of those teams, all three of those teams, I think, are 6-6, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They are.
So that's a huge game for Tennessee, which may help us out. I'm actually more worried about what happens between the Steelers and the Ravens in the AFC North, because I think Denver, they may lose all four of those remaining games, just looking at how brutal that schedule is. They may get lucky, and if Oakland is clinched, maybe the Oakland rests their starters on New Year's Day, but that just seems like a brutal four-game stretch. So
yeah, I think you're right in thinking that. I'm thinking about that Week 17 game, too. I think on Thursday, we really need to root for the Chiefs to beat the Raiders to make that division race much tighter. And also, by doing that, the Raiders would fall back, and the Patriots could possibly gain a game in the home field advantage race, which would make them not want to play their stars in Week 17 if they have it wrapped up, because as Chris Kaufman mentioned on thefins.com, CK Parrott, he mentioned that if the Patriots have things wrapped up for the one seed and they're playing us and we have a chance to get into the playoffs, they're not going to show us anything. They're going to rest guys. They're not going to show us any of their game plan. They're going to let us win in case they beat us or they meet us in the playoffs again, where they can just annihilate us up in Foxborough in the divisional round. So I think that is something to keep your eye on. And I'm with you on Denver, man. I'm not impressed with that team at all. They can't run the ball. Siemian, they mentioned on Friday he took the walking boot off and tried to walk on it, and they put it right back on because it was so banged up. So if he's going to miss a game, this is the best one for him to miss, because he comes back against New England, they're not beating them, and then at Kansas City is a tough game. So really hoping that they do fall apart. And I think you were going to talk about some of those AFC North teams, I'm guessing, is who you were going to talk about next.
Yeah, so the interesting thing to me is I almost think we may actually need to be rooting for two of our AFC East rivals this weekend, just because of wild card scenarios and things like that. Even the schedule here real quick, but Pittsburgh actually plays at Buffalo. Their schedule is somewhat soft. They play at Buffalo. They play at Cincinnati, who usually gives them a tough game. Then they get the Ravens and the Browns at home. The Ravens, on the other hand, let me see if I can pull up their schedule here real quick.
They are at New England, home for Philadelphia, at Pittsburgh, and at Cincinnati.
Yeah. So I almost think, in order to help Miami's chances, because I think the division title is a long, long shot at this point, I almost think we need to root for New England and Buffalo to beat Pittsburgh and Baltimore this weekend. I had that reverse. New England plays Baltimore and Buffalo plays Pittsburgh. But what's your take on that? Do we root for the Bills and the Patriots this weekend just to help our wild card chances?
100, 1,000% on the Patriots. There's no question about that. We're not winning the AFC East. That dream is over. Losing to the Ravens ended that dream. So 100%. Think you're right there. If the Ravens beat the Patriots, we're in real trouble for the wild card spot because, like you said, Pittsburgh's schedule really softens up there towards the end. So if we get Baltimore to lose one more game before they go into Pittsburgh for that pivotal AFC North showdown, if they lose just one of those games, we'll be okay at 10-6 because they can't get to 10-6. Both those teams wouldn't be able to get to 10-6 at that point. And if it's the Steelers that are 10-6, we have the tiebreaker on them. So. I think if Baltimore loses the game to New England, we're pretty much okay as far as the AFC North is concerned. Buffalo, yeah, it would be good for them to win. I'm not going to count on it, but that is definitely – I think you're correct there too. So rooting for the AFC East this weekend.
And I think one of the other tricky aspects of it too, though, is if for some reason Baltimore goes into New England and wins, which isn't entirely out of the realm of possibility. They've always seemed to play New England tough on the road. Then I think at that point we have to root for Pittsburgh to lose out and Baltimore to win out just to give us that wild card spot.
Yeah, I think you're right. I'm just not a believer in Baltimore, even though they beat the crap out of us. I've been down on them before this game and all year, so I'm just going to – I don't think they're going to have a chance in that game. They do play them tough, you're right. I mean, the Danelle Ellerbe game a few years ago with the interceptions and stuff on Tom Brady. Mm-hmm. So there's a memory berry for you, Danelle Ellerbe, the worst linebacker in Dolphins history. So, yeah, I'm with you on that. I think I just think our biggest competition right now is going to be the Broncos and possibly the Steelers-Ravens, but I think we'll be okay there. Just as long as the Dolphins get 10-6, I think they'll make it in. And it starts this week with Arizona. Beat Arizona. Everyone's going to be feeling good again, right back to where they were, because that Saturday night game against the Jets should be one they handle as well. So I'm just hoping, man, that Christmas Eve at Buffalo is for all the marbles. That would be a sweet redemption game for us to get back. From 2013, we laid an egg up there in the exact same scenario 3 years ago. Yeah. And hopefully you can unleash Mario Williams in that game and he can do pretty much what he came here to do, just to beat Buffalo twice, which he took care of once already. So
here's a quick trivia question. Who was the last Dolphins quarterback to win a game at Buffalo?
Was it Matt Moore?
It was 2011.
That was Reggie Bush that won that game though. He had like 200 something rushing yards, but no, that's a good point. Yeah, man, that's fun. So let's hope that we get to that point. If we don't get to that point, if we lose to Arizona, if we lose to Buffalo, we lose two more games, we're done. And if that is the case, the next thing we have to look forward to is free agency and then the draft, of course, which brings us to our final segment of the night, which is where me and Kevin look at a couple of draft prospects. And Kevin, I will let you go first because I'm on defense too, but I'm going to let you start with the defense first.
Okay. Well, you mentioned Chris Kaufman, CK Parrothead, and CK Parrot on Twitter. Just previously, he actually kind of turned me on to this guy I'm going to talk about tonight. His name is Charles Harris. He's a defensive end from the University of Missouri. And just looking at him, he's 6'3", 260, long, lean. He's fast. He's got a pretty good get off the same way Cameron Wake does. Just listen to some of these games he's had, though. And defensive ends usually don't make a lot of tackles, but he's had, let me count them up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 games this year where he's had at least 6 tackles in a game. And then he's had 2 games of 7, another game with 8, and another game with 9. He's had 3 sacks against Georgia, 2.5 against Vandy, 2 against South Carolina. He has 9 sacks on the season, 2 forced fumbles, 2 passes deflected. I think he's one of those guys that a lot of people don't maybe know about just because Missouri had a down year. They went 4-8. They're not in a bowl game. I think he will explode in the combine, and I think he's a surefire first rounder after his combine workouts if they go the way I think they will.
That matches up really kind of perfectly with who I was going to pick next, because I think that this team is probably going to need two defensive ends this coming offseason, if not both in the draft. And so my other one is defensive end that could go later in the draft, I think. At least I thought so early on, but he really turned it on. I saw him back on like a Friday night. They played, I think, Clemson. And I was watching Deshaun Watson and Wayne Gallman and Mike Williams and Ben Bulwer and all those guys for Clemson that I'm excited to look at in the draft. And I saw this number 7 playing defensive end for Boston College. And his name's Harold Landry. And he has 15 sacks on the year now. He's just racking up sacks at a ridiculous pace. He's a 6'3", 250-pound, you know, long wingspan, good burst off the edge type of guy. I think he could be a later-round guy. I'm not really sure. I haven't done a whole lot of work on him, but that's what I saw from watching him live. I'd like to go back and look at some of his tape, but if we need to double-dip on defensive end, I wouldn't mind going with your guy Charles Harris or Taco Charlton, who you talked about earlier, and then coming back later in the draft and going with Harold Landry from Boston College, who pretty much is the only thing that defense had going for it all year. So a couple of defensive ends.
I pulled up his stats from that Clemson game, too. He had 6 total tackles, 5 solo. He had one of those for loss, 1 sack, a forced fumble, and a pass deflection. So that's a pretty good night for a DN.
No kidding, right? I mean, so you turn on the tape of a team that's in the college playoff, and you see a 6-6 Boston College team that's barely got into like a, you know, Belk Bowl game or whatever the hell they call them these days, and you see that guy flash. So it's pretty impressive, and it definitely stands out for you. So before I wrap up the episode here, Kevin, you got any last words you want to give me?
Yeah, so I've got to tell you my quick story from over the weekend. So, you know, most of you who know me know I'm a big Dayton Flyers basketball fan. They won their game on Saturday. They won tonight, so that's been going well. Arsenal had a big day today. They won their group in the Champions League. That was kind of surprising. I didn't think PSG would have a draw against Ludogorets, but they did. So 2 wins out of there kind of cleaned up for the Dolphins loss. But I've got to tell you about the worst fantasy football beat I've ever had real quick. So just a quick 2-minute story. So the owner of my company is the son of the St. Louis Cardinals baseball team's owner. He got us into this high-stakes fantasy football league, and we get to play with some of the Cincinnati Reds players here in town. I actually made it to the finals of our divisional thing. And if you win the division, you get to play against some of the winners from the other baseball teams that participate in this. So I made it in to the playoffs with a 5-6 record because I had the second most points. I had 4 losses on the year where I had the second most points in the entire league, and I lost to the person who had the most for that week. Somehow I upset the number 1 and the number 2 seed, and I got to play Zach Cozart last night. And I was up by 31.5 points. He came back, and fucking Andrew Luck, who I've always loved, I have him in another league, and he's just stunk all year. But that explosion he had last night caused me to lose to Zach fucking Cozart by 1.15 points. I think I'm done playing fantasy football forever from here on out.
Hey,
that's the worst bad beat I've ever had.
I'm with you on the fantasy football thing. I really fell off of it this year when I got into Perfectville and really started paying more attention to the game as itself. And I also bet on a lot of football too. So I'm over the fantasy train. I'm glad you might be as well. That's pretty good, man. So let me ask you, when you say high stakes, how much are we talking here?
Our owner paid, I think, above $15,000 to have 10 teams in this league.
Holy crap. Okay, so that's quite a bit of money.
It's not my money, but I do know if you want to like buy in as an individual, it's, I think, $1,100 per team. And we ended up getting a slight discount just for buying as many teams as we did. But if I had won, I would have gone into the semifinal rounds. And the grand prize, if a non-baseball player wins, it's like a trip for 2 on a cruise around the Caribbean. So I'm pretty bummed I lost on that by 1.15 points thanks to Andrew Luck. And he's like one of my favorite players to root for. So.
That's where you and I differ, my friend. Meeting. That's funny. Well, that's definitely not chump change. We are definitely dealing with chump change from the Dolphins' last effort against the Ravens. But here at Welcome to Perfectville on the Finalysis podcast, we're better than that, so we're going to keep bringing you guys episodes. That's going to do it for us tonight from the Finalysis podcast. Like I said, don't forget to check out the Welcome to Perfectville podcast with Sam Marcoux and Chris Colon, the Write Travis Write blog at welcometoperfectville.com, and Kevin will be posting out his Wide 9 origins and kind of descriptions post on the blog as well next week, so keep an eye out for that. The Findry Report with Almost Dr. Will Maring. We've got a ton of things planned for this offseason for you guys. We had a big meeting on Saturday, a town hall meeting, if you will, of Perfectville, where Kevin, Chris, Sam, and I discussed some of the future things for Perfectville, so keep an eye out for that. And even if the Dolphins don't get their winning ways figured out again, we will have you guys covered for here until the end of time, hopefully. So that's going to do it for us. Kevin, anything else you want to say?
Fins up. Time to start a new streak this weekend.
Fins up. Let's get it. Beat the Cardinals and get back to 8-5 and get back on the winning way. All right. Have a good night, guys.
Thanks for listening to The Finalysis with Travis Wingfield and Kevin Dern. Subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes, and go to WelcomeToPerfectVille.com for the very best coverage of your Miami Dolphins. Fins up.